It's Monday, April 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, International Edition exposes potential global financial corruption involving 140 politicians and more than 50 countries.
We have been able to identify 140 politicians and public officials from around the world who have offshore entities.
We hear from one of the journalists involved in this massive Panama Papers project. Also ahead, the Supreme Court and U.S. politics, free music from a top country star. It's all on today's International Edition. A team of international journalists working with leaked documents from a Panamanian law firm has concluded that associates of Russian President Vladimir Putin have moved as much as $2 billion through offshore bank accounts over a nearly 40-year period. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists said in a report Sunday that the 11.5 million records from Panama's Mossack Fonseca law firm show dozens of transactions involving people or companies linked to Putin that extended from 1977 through the end of last year. Parking money in offshore accounts is not necessarily illegal and can be used to establish legal tax shelters or ease international business deals. But the report said the documents show that banks, law firms, and other offshore players have often failed to follow legal requirements that they make sure their clients are not involved in criminal enterprises, tax dodging, or political corruption. Michael Hudson is a senior editor of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. He spoke by phone today from New York with my colleague Michael Lippin, who began asking him how he got involved in the Panama Papers project.
We had been doing lots of reporting on the offshore world, and it had gotten a series of leaks, smaller leaks. They weren't small at the time. They were considered huge, but compared to what we have now, they were fairly small. We'd gotten a series of leaks about the offshore holdings of politicians, criminals, celebrities, and had been reporting on that really with an eye to showing how the offshore world works for the last 3 or 4 years. This was a new leak that came in through one of our partners in Germany, and they came to us knowing that we had the ability to bring people together around the world to really dig into this. The leak is 11.5 million documents. It has information about 210,000 offshore companies and other entities. It stretches, the information stretches from 1977 to the end of 2015. And there's no way that one journalist, one lone wolf, or one news organization could really dig into this. So we put together a team of people, more than 370 journalists from 70 countries and more than 100 news organizations have worked on this project, which is now stretched out for more than a year.
And what did you think when you found out that the German newspaper had acquired access to so many more documents than you'd ever seen in these other leak cases?
Well, we were excited, but there's always a sense of skeptical excitement because, you know, you can have a leak and, you know, you've got to do the work inside the documents. For us, it's not just a matter of, you know, posting a bunch of documents online and telling the world to go at it. Our job is to dig into it and make the connections and find the names, make the connections between international scandals, between political policies, between politicians, et cetera, you know, and dig into that and make sense of it. So, you know, we were excited, but we also, you know, held judgment on exactly how important this was or how good it was until we spent the time in the documents. But I can tell you that as my colleagues who started out working on this before I did began digging, they became increasingly excited and confident that we had something really important.
And why is it so important to you to be able to show the world how these secretive corporate processes work?
Because this is really sort of the shadow side of our global economy, the money that flows around, you know, mostly unchecked, undetected. And it's important to know, you know, it's important to have some transparency when you're talking about billions and trillions of dollars, about who controls that money, where is it going, are taxes being paid on it. Without some sort of sense of how the offshore system works, you really can't know how the global economy works. And you know, one thing that's really important is anytime there's a grand corruption case, a big political corruption episode, a giant Ponzi scheme like the Madoff scheme, there will be an offshore element to it.
Well, for you, what were the most, concerning or alarming findings?
Well, one of the things that really struck out at us was the number of politicians. We have been able to identify 140 politicians and public officials from around the world who have offshore entities, including 12 world leaders. That's presidents, prime ministers, kings, that includes the prime ministers of Iceland and Pakistan, King Saul of Saudi Arabia. You can't say in every single case that someone is doing something wrong or that they're hiding improper practices, but it certainly raises lots of questions about transparency when you have politicians and especially top leaders of countries moving their holdings offshore and using offshore entities to kind of obscure what they're doing.
We will hear more from Michael Hudson in just a few minutes, but first we turn to our social media segment, and you can imagine there's a lot online about this. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here in the studio to bring us what's trending. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Where and what did you find out about the Panama Papers?
So I mainly looked into three Twitter accounts, and here's the first one that I found. It's the German daily Süddeutsche Zeitung's account, and its handle is @SZ. That's much easier than pronouncing the whole company. Most of its tweets are in German, but it released a 52-second-long video describing how the Panama Gate unfolded. And that's actually another trending hashtag, by the way, #PanamaGate and #Panama Papers. The caption to the video reads like this. This is a leak. 2.6 terabytes of data, 11.5 million documents, and 214,000 shell companies. The Panama Papers are the largest data leak journalists have ever worked with. Around 900 people retweeted that shortly before our show started, but judging by the rapidly growing interest for this topic, I'm sure that number could have easily exceeded 1,000 by now.
Well, gee, how influential is this paper?
It's the largest German newspaper. It has more than 1 million readers on a daily basis in Germany and also enjoys a relatively high circulation abroad. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that the editorial stance is quite liberal.
What other accounts did you look into?
The ICIJ, or the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. The organization broke the news and teased about it on Twitter about 6 hours ago. It wrote, "In 2 hours, the ICJI will be publishing a new investigation. Stay tuned." And added the hashtag, you guessed it, #PanamaPapers. Now, when it broke the news, it tweeted, "Breaking, the #PanamaPapers, politicians, criminals, and the rogue industry that hides their cash," and linked it to their website. To that tweet, many people wondered why no Americans are involved in this and also asked whether the database will be available to the public. And last but not least, I also looked into the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden's account @Snowden for two reasons. First, he was tagged in almost all of the replies to the ICIJ tweet, and also he's actively tweeting and retweeting about the Panama Papers story today. Jim?
Well, just as we are as well. Mm-hmm. Thank you for being here, G, and giving us that report. She tweets for our VOA International Edition Twitter account @VOA_IE. You can follow her on her own account @GAbbyLee. I'm out there as well @VOA Stevenson. We've already tweeted extensively about this and will continue to do so. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. We, along with millions around the world, are now looking at the just-released Panama Papers, which appear to show billions of dollars of questionable transactions over many years. Michael Hudson is a senior editor of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists who released the report and who, in speaking with International Edition's Michael Lippin, says the trail involves many people close to prominent world figures.
The other big thing that jumped at us was the number of family members and associates of top leaders that we identified as doing business in the offshore world. That includes people like the godfather of Putin's daughter, who the records show us played a part in a network of covert maneuvers by banks and companies that were closely tied to Putin. And, you know, we have the records showing offshore companies linked to this network, moving money and transactions as large as $200 million at a time.
Well, regarding Russian President Putin, is there any evidence from the leaked documents that he or his associates were actually involved in activity that would be, you know, considered criminal in Russia?
That's not a question I can answer. Because I don't know Russian criminal law enough. We just know that people close to Putin who are linked by friendship or by business relationships are involved in a lot of transactions that are very untransparent, that are being done in a quiet and perhaps even secretive way, and moving large chunks of money. It raises very serious questions. Now, I should note that, you know, we sent lots of questions to the Kremlin, very detailed questions, and the Kremlin has refused to answer the questions. They did go public several days ago in an effort to preempt our story by charging that ICIJ and its media partners were preparing what a Kremlin spokesman called a information attack on Putin and people close to him.
And what do you think of that allegation?
Well, you know, it's not an attack. It's journalism. And, reporting on the financial affairs of public officials around the world, that's not an attack. You know, we think it's a public service.
Well, there was also a response from Mossack Fonseca to the publication of these reports. The company said that it does due diligence on its clients to make sure they're not involved in criminal acts. The company said it's not responsible for how its clients manage their companies. And Mossack Fonseca even hinted that it might take legal action against those involved in publishing this leaked information. What do you think about Mossack Fonseca's response to your report?
Well, I can tell you that Mossack Fonseca's argument is that, yes, we set up offshore companies for people around the world, but they're not really our clients. We work through other law firms and big banks that bring us people. They're our real clients. And, you know, the analogy they use is, oh, well, you know, we're like a car factory. Our liability ends once the car is produced. You can't, you know, blaming Mossack Fonseca for what people do with their companies would be like blaming an automaker if the car is used in a robbery.
Is that fair or not?
We think that the story goes much deeper than that. We have numerous examples of Mossack Fonseca either unknowingly or knowingly working with very questionable characters. That includes at least 33 people and companies blacklisted by the U.S. government because of evidence that they'd been involved in wrongdoing, such as doing business with Mexican drug lords or terrorist organizations like Hezbollah.
This is a very big story and very complex, and as the magnitude of the Panama Papers begins to unfold, you may keep up with the latest developments at voanews.com. Donald Trump's White House ambitions may stumble a bit in a vote in Wisconsin this week as politics in Washington continues to buzz around the latest Supreme Court nomination. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins us to get caught up on these stories.
Jim, Congress is returning to Washington after a two-week recess. And I have to say that there's really nothing in terms of legislation right now, anything in front of Congress that is nearly as interesting as the sort of sideshows. Mm-hmm. President Obama's pick to replace Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court seemingly going nowhere with the Republican-controlled Senate. And a very interesting presidential race that continues to play itself out at the primary level this week.
Well, let's touch on the Supreme Court briefly. It seems like a lot of the furor over this has died down. I really haven't heard much about it in the past week.
Well, you haven't heard too much about it because senators have been at home in their home states, presumably meeting with their constituents to try and get the pulse of their constituents on how to proceed on this. We are still facing the basic math where Republicans control the chamber, and only two of the Republicans in that chamber have called for confirmation hearings and a vote. As long as it's only two, if the rest of the Republican conference holds strong, Merrick Garland, who is a federal appellate judge here in Washington, D.C., will not make it onto the Supreme Court, at least not this year.
While there may not be a vote on the Supreme Court imminently, there will be a vote Tuesday in Wisconsin that a lot of people are watching, and that will have to do with Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, who is having apparently some issues in Wisconsin ahead of this race.
He's having issues in Wisconsin, and if polls are to be believed, he's having issues with about half the American electorate, the female half of the electorate. Last week, he made some comments initially suggesting that that if abortion were to be illegal, that women who have an abortion would have to face legal consequences. He tried to walk that back, but that really hasn't seemed to work. The Wisconsin GOP is rallying around Ted Cruz or John Kasich, and basically anyone other than Donald Trump. And that is the big prize on Tuesday. And if they can stop Donald Trump in Wisconsin, then they feel that maybe they can slow his momentum elsewhere, and then maybe his march to the nomination could be halted.
One thing we're certainly happy about is to have Senate correspondent Michael Bowman with us to analyze it each and every week. Mike, thanks for stopping by.
Always a pleasure, Jim. Thanks.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Country music musician Eric Church is up for 6 awards at the Academy of Country Music Awards later today. But he released his new album, Mr. Misunderstood, to his fans absolutely free of charge. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, Church wanted fans to get the music because they're the reason he plays.
Hitting with a kid in your high top shoes, sitting in the back of the class, I was just like you. Always left out, never fit in on that path you're walking in. Mr. Misunderstood.
Eric Church loves music, and he loves people who love music like he does. That's why, when it was time to release his fifth studio album, Mr. Misunderstood, he skipped the normal route and went straight to the fans. Church sent the album to the 80,000 members of his fan club, either on vinyl, CD, download, or streaming. No charge. The singer said that he wanted to skip the normal process and do something special for the people who have stuck with him.
My big beef with the music industry is the label gets it first, the critics get it, the press gets it, the last people to get the record are the fans. But that's who you're trying to get the record to. So for me, and the way our career has been, it was important to let the fans be that mouthpiece and tell everybody else about it. So we did it snail mail, old school, sent them vinyl, and didn't tell them it was coming.
Eric has been riding a wave of success since the release of his third studio album, Chief, in 2011. That album debuted at number one on the Billboard 200 chart. It earned him his first Grammy nomination, and spawned his first two number one country songs, Springsteen and Drink in My Hand. His fourth studio album, The Outsiders, produced five singles, including the title track, Give Me Back My Hometown, Cold One, Talladega, and Like a Wrecking Ball. It also went platinum with more than 1 million sold by November of 2015. Church says that for Mr. Misunderstood, he wanted the album in the fans' hands as soon as possible.
I care for the people that believe, and I want it for the ones that were there when there were 10 people in a place, and they screamed like there were 10,000. And now that there's 10,000, they're still there, and they're screaming. I want it for them, the people that bought in and believed.
To keep the process secret for the general public sales, the vinyl records had to be pressed in Germany and shipped back to the United States. The CDs were sold to major retailers disguised as a Christmas album compilation. Eric says he is counting on the word of mouth of his fans to push album sales for Mr. Misunderstood without having to go the normal route of promotional photos, radio appearances, and talk shows.
The music is the most important thing. And we made this entire release about the music. Now, whether that works or not, we'll see, but I believe that. That's why I do what I do. So we really put our faith in the fans' hands and let them tell people about it.
Eric Church is up for the ACM Entertainer of the Year Award, the Male Vocalist of the Year, the Vocal Event of the Year, and Song of the Year for Raise 'Em Up with Keith Urban. Mr. Misunderstood is also nominated for Album of the Year and Video of the Year. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com, and we're also out there on Twitter. Follow us at @VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Daryl Smith, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you so much for joining us. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When leaders of the world's eight top industrial countries, also known as G8, met in L'Aquila, Italy in 2009, the global economic recession and escalating food prices had pushed over 1 billion people into food insecurity. In short, over 1 in 6 people went to bed hungry most nights. Determined to do something about the problem, President Barack Obama announced Feed the Future, a U.S. government interagency initiative to fight global hunger in 19 countries, largely through focusing on smallholder farmers, particularly women. So we can better understand what works and what doesn't, right from the beginning, the performance and impact of individual Feed the Future programs were evaluated and the results collected by the Peace Corps, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, which leads the initiative. In mid-March, little more than 5 years after Feed the Future was launched, the collected information was synthesized and issued as a report. So what is the best way to eliminate hunger? According to the report's findings, when it comes to development, people and relationships matter most. When our development programs leveraged strong community relationships and trusted and transparent community-based organizations, they were better able to achieve their objectives, such as building resilience, expanding markets, closing gender gaps, and lifting vulnerable people out of poverty, wrote Emily Hoag and Zachary Beckett in a recent blog post. Both are involved with Feed the Future. It is also worth noting that successful programs within Feed the Future shared some elements. Today we know that large-scale impact necessitates a long-term effort. Successful programs invest in research and development and promote coordination among partners. And crucially, projects that integrate quality training as part of their activities with the community can lead not only to successful change, but also lasting change. Through Feed the Future, we are reducing poverty and malnutrition around the world, and we are learning from these accomplishments. Feed the Future, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith, is a powerful example of what we can achieve when the world comes together around a shared global challenge, working with countries that want to take ownership of, contribute to, and be accountable for improving their food security.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.